You may know you're listening to this show along the Marketing Podcast Network, but did you know there are other great shows on MPN to help your business? Christy Hyler hosts a fantastic podcast called Own It. Christy, tell us more about the show.
Own It is all about celebrating women and non-binary advertising agency owners. We talk about buying out of the Boys Club of Advertising because less than 1% of ad agencies are owned by women.
And where can people subscribe?
You can find the podcast at untilyouownit.com. We're also on the Marketing Podcast Network at marketingpodcast.net. And of course, you can subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
You heard her. Go subscribe.
On Brand is brought to you by the Brand Driven Digital Event Series, featuring Digital Strategy Bootcamp. This day-long, intensive, and interactive workshop helps you ground your digital marketing with a solid strategy that you can share with your team. Learn more and register now at branddrivenbootcamp.com.
Welcome to On Brand, a podcast for brand builders by brand builders. Here's your host, Nick Westergaard of Brand Driven Digital.
Hey, brand builders, have we got a show for you? Today's guest is Justin Foster. Justin is a noted expert on business and personal branding, as well as generational shifts and technological trends. In addition to branding and marketing, he's frequently requested to speak and consult on Gen Y engagement, social media, startups, and more. Justin is the author of Oatmeal vs. Bacon, How to Differentiate in a Generic World, and Human Bacon, A Man's Guide to Creating an Awesome Personal Brand. Justin is the co-founder and CMO of Cloud.com, the creators of SlideCloud, a cloud-based presentation platform. In addition to his business ventures, Justin provides corporate and personal brand consulting through Price Associates. Over the past 20 years, Justin has worked as an executive in sales and marketing for large corporations and small businesses, co-founded two marketing firms, and conducted over 400 workshops and seminars. Justin works with organizations and individuals to create memorable first impressions, communicate clear messages, and select the right tools to inspire and attract audiences. The result? A meaningful, relevant presence in the marketplace. Justin, welcome to On Brand.
Thank you very much, Nick. I'm honored to be asked to join you.
So I have to ask, going out of the gate with all of the bacon up front, why bacon?
Well, bacon is perpetually interesting, and I've always used metaphors and analogies as sort of teaching mechanisms. You know, it worked for Aesop and Jesus and Gandhi and others, so I'm not comparing myself to them, but I do appreciate their teaching methodologies. And a few years ago, I stumbled across the comedian Jim Gaffigan, and who had this little bit that he does on bacon, and it struck me that that might be the ultimate branding metaphor, and it led to a book and a whole bunch of speeches about it, and then another book and a whole bunch more speeches, and indeed, I think I have stumbled across the ultimate metaphor for a perpetually interesting brand, whether that brand be an individual or an entity.
You would be talking about Bippity Boppity Bacon. from Mr. Jim Gaffigan, who I'm I'm a big fan of as well, being a fellow five-kid crazy person juggler like that.
So, yeah, and a Midwesterner too, as he is. Not
true.
Anymore. Yeah,
this
he lives
true.
In New York now, but he's from the Midwest originally.
Yeah, yeah, Indiana, I think.
And correct.
I'm not nearly as pale, so he's still got the market
yes,
cornered there. But you talk about bacon being the metaphor for the, did you say perpetually interesting?
Yeah, perpetually interesting brands. Brands that seem to just make marketing and branding and relevance almost easy. It seems easy for them. And as I dug into the metaphor, it really, there is a lot of brand science and corporate psychology, cultural dynamics, down to the science of intrinsic versus extrinsic value. So what on the surface is almost a silly or irreverent metaphor is actually the top of a very deep, broad subject around what does it take to build a brand today in this very fragmented world where demographic shifts and social media and innovators coming from all different corners of the industry, all of those conditions, underneath it is this this real scientific approach to being perpetually interesting.
So what do you find yourself, in thinking of the example of parables, what parable on bacon to branding do you find yourself most often unpacking for audiences?
Yeah, it's at the root of three concepts that using bacon as the parable the metaphor is that the first is that bacon has marketing integrated into its existence. It's not something it has to force to do. And you compare it to oatmeal, which is the comparison in the book. Oatmeal requires a lot of marketing in the packaging, and then it requires a lot of marketing in the presentation because no one really eats oatmeal plain. The second one is that oatmeal is a intellectual left brain purchase. I'm eating this to make myself feel better about myself. Bacon is distinctly a left brain decision, even though it's got a little bit of a negative reputation for being unhealthy. It's actually part of a lot of meal plans in modern nutrition. But anyway, so that's the second one, is that it's that part of the relationship to the metaphor. And the third one is the bacon, the aroma of bacon. I use that little sub metaphor to describe that as the culture of a company. So when a company has a great culture internally, which starts with their leadership team and their the behaviors and habits of their leadership team, then that creates an essence or aroma that comes off the brand that people can smell from a, metaphorical sense.
So it's kind of that intangible aspect that is in many ways hard to create, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And I think that's because branding for years, and I still think this is a habit that a lot of marketers and brandings have, branding was considered to be the development of outside perception. And that's how you did it. You were going to go create a brand. And I challenge that across the board. I believe that branding is the external amplification of that, what makes you inwardly awesome. So in the metaphor, turkey bacon or tofu bacon indeed are not bacon. They're fake bacon.
Faking.
They're faking, exactly. So if you look at all modern, great modern brands from Zappos to Amazon to Google, they did not advertise their way to prominence. They executed their culture and their culture of innovation, their culture of differentiation, their culture of disruption. They all executed those in a way that created a presence in the marketplace through the experience with the brand, by tasting the brand. They did not create an outside perception and then try to live up to it.
Well, and I think there's all of the – I mean, I think that's one of the big shifts in branding too, is the move from kind of the – and again, like the media shifts you've been mentioning are a big supporter of that too, that you can't kind of use that marketing megaphone to, bully people into, shifting to that, that outside perception. You have to – involve them in kind of that more multi-directional conversation.
Yep, exactly. And I think it's the three big trends I think that created this are I mentioned some of them already, but the social mobile trend, the fact that there's a brand amplifier in the hands of 80 some percent of the marketplace. And one of the things I tell my clients or audiences is that you have to assume that everyone that touches your brand, employees, customers, community, influencers, media, whatever, that they have a smartphone, an ADD, and an opinion. And when you understand that there's thousands and thousands and thousands of amplifiers plugged into a brand, it creates a sort of a mythology that you can actually manage the brand through some sort of external persuasion mechanism. The second one is then the millennial generation that is dominating now, becoming the number one buying group. Certainly the number one buying group in influence, but even in dollar buying power, and their media habits and the ways that they emotionally connect to brands are distinctly different than Gen Xers or boomers. And then the third is the rise of innovation you know, the Internet of Things, the fact that you get innovation from very unique sectors, where, you know, from the Dr. Dre is one of my favorite examples, where he's a, you know, a hip hop guy, a producer, then he invents Beats headphones, and Beats headphones transforms a commoditized industry. And no one would have predicted that. And those three types of external pressures are then adding to the internal pressures of, you know, senior executives and companies and older marketers that are essentially everything they learned about marketing is gone. You know, the four P's, and, you know, we're going to do an ad buy and run a campaign. And that really only works with a very small segment of the population now. You have to approach the marketplace as you would approach an actual relationship from a very individualized standpoint.
So talk a little bit about, you know, in your bio, it talks about, you know, you working a lot on understanding some of the trends around Gen Y, millennials. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. How are they connecting with brands in a way that's different?
Well, first, the way that they learn about a brand is not through traditional marketing. You know, they're not going to drive by a billboard or see an ad in the newspaper or hear a radio ad. They just doesn't match their consumer habits unless they are, and across millennials, that just doesn't happen. So that's the first thing that makes that is the relationship with the brand, is they hear about brands the same way they hear about their relationships in real life. They hear about it from other people. The second thing is that what appears to be a dichotomy in some of the universal habits. And that dichotomy is that they are highly individualistic, but also highly social. And what that means is that they like things that are a reflection of what they believe in. That's the individualistic aspect of millennials. So they will beg and borrow and work to get to purchase from brands that they feel they have an emotional connection with. And then the third thing is that they are the new influencer to really every brand, because they, as employees, and especially if they're in leadership roles inside of companies, they influence across the entire spectrum of the company. They're strategic, they're aggressive, they have opinions, they don't accept old ways as the way things have always been done. And then from a consumer standpoint, the same thing applies, that they don't accept standard norms of how they're supposed to behave. And so if they have an opinion, they will post it on Yelp or post it on Twitter or Facebook, whether that opinion be positive or negative. They assume a certain right to talk about your brand that is in none of the talking points that the PR department distributed.
So, you know, I always try to draw out things that, you know, we hear about brands that we kind of have a tendency to nod along with, that, yep, that's a good thing. But they sometimes end up as only being those nodders that are really complex, amorphous topics. But you talk about creating an emotional connection mm-hmm. with a brand. Mm-hmm. How is that done? What does that look like on someone's to-do list?
So I think it always starts inwardly, and it always starts inwardly with what I would refer to as a cultural audit, which is essentially this: what do we believe in? And emotional connections, true emotional connections, are not just the law of attraction, some sort of surface connection. They're almost a, for lack of a better term, a spiritual connection to a brand. That might even be a better word than emotional. So in essence, it's when a buyer, a in-tune buyer, a consumer who has access to everything they need to know about your brand through their network or through, you know, searching reviews or whatever, when they approach that brand, essentially the first benchmark beyond attraction is, does this brand believe what I believe? And so if an organization doesn't know what they believe in, especially at the senior leadership level, there is no emotional connection. And I think then the experience has to match. And so you have to trigger the law of engagement, which is if you want to create a long-term emotional engagement or emotional connection to a brand, the way that you say that an experience is going to go has to match it. if you make a brand, you know, that's the proverbial brand promise, but it's the brand promise around more of a relationship promise, which is that I will honor that you are a customer and you have feelings and you have ideas and you're a unique human being. And very, very few brands have figured out how to pull that off that are mega brands, but it's rampant in small business. If you go to, you know, most small businesses figured that a long time ago because they have to from a survival or growth mechanism. Mega brands, large brands are just now figuring that out.
It's interesting. You know, you don't often hear that because so many times you think, oh, you know, who really knows branding? You know, Zappos, Apple, Nike. And not that they don't.
They do.
But I think we do neglect the country, like you said, because of the do or die nature of small business.
Right.
You either have to have a brand that stands for something that people want to be a part of, I mean, or you sell a commodity and you just stay open by the very nature of the business ecosystem that you serve. But by and large, you have to have something that you stand for.
That's right. That's very well said. You have to have something that you stand for. And that starts at the leadership team. It does not start in the marketing department. It does not start in the HR department. It starts with whoever the senior leaders are. And this is the biggest challenge that large brands are dealing with is that they have this and I just kind of repeat myself here, but very, very left brain, very extrinsic mindset about who their audience is. They use the language of invasion and occupation. They use the language like target and client acquisition and blah, blah, blah. And it's all very aggressive. That's why, not coincidentally, that companies that have a strong female presence in their leadership teams are much, much more adept at emotional connections and nurturing and cultivating relationships with the marketplace. It's almost a stark difference between sort of the traditional, you know, executive that you think of visually as executive to organizations that have a strong strong women leaders in leadership positions in the company.
You know, you talk about it starts with the leaders, and I think that is a nugget worth pulling out as well, and almost seems like it could be a pretty decent explanation for why there's success at the small business level, because the leader in a smaller business is usually not that far from the customer.
That's right.
They are, you know, if they're not out on, you know, on the store floor, the storefront, they're at least in an off. They're usually on site. You know, it would be hard for them not to see a customer in some form or another during the course of their day. Versus that other level of being removed physically, but then I think you also get physically removed from the work too. And you say, that's what my CMO's for. That's right. And I think you lose some of that vision.
You do, and I think Nick, I think part of that is that there's a massive convergence that's happening now, and that is where leadership style and culture and customer experience are now almost overlapping. So another way to say that is how leaders treat their people is how the people treat the customers, which is that becomes the brand. And you look at the every day. There's some example of stupidity on the part of a company on how they treat people.
Yeah.
And that's one of my mantras is that every bad brand decision started as a bad leadership decision. And this is what happens to be somewhat idealistic about it. This is what happens when you have jerks and bullies running companies. They don't have any concept of the intrinsic value of a human. So why would it make any sense for them to treat their employees different? And that's where you can trace it back. You trace a branding disaster back where one of the cable companies is putting slurs about their customers in their notes, and those notes are getting released. Somebody created a culture at those cable companies that encouraged that behavior, and that's why one of the things I constantly preach is there's no business to consumer. There's no business to business. There's no companies don't buy anything. Companies don't sell anything. People sell and buy, especially in the social business era that we're in now. And so if you have a bunch of people that lack self-awareness, or they are, insert your best term here for lower body part. if they're like that in a leadership position, imagine the negative impact on the brand, and then the job that then marketers are left to try to come up with, some ad campaign that covers up the terrible culture. It's like taking a poop sandwich and marketing it as a BLT. That's a tough job to have.
Good. And you slightly reintroduced bacon into the conversation.
Look at me being a branding guy.
I was going to say, look at that.
It's very natural for me.
Before, because I actually had a bacon-related follow-up question. But before, real quick, as someone that tosses around the phrase brand promise, because it's one I like better than all the other bad vocab in our industry in terms of slogan, tagline, they're all things that we kind of graft on, like you said. It seems like even their names don't imply that they have any kind of depth or extended shelf life potential. But I like the idea of a brand promise. But what's your, for the people nodding along with that, what's your best, kind of quick description if someone says, what's that?
I think it's very simple. I think your brand promise is the leadership team's promise to how they will treat the people that touch the brand. So that extends first to the employees, then to the customers, the community, the industry that they're in. Don't be the reason that people quit. Don't be the reason that people file complaints with the Better Business Bureau. Don't be the reason that you have people protest your corporate behavior. It's the promise that you make of how you will treat the people that touch the brand.
I like that. That's good, because like you said, and it kind of ties back to your bigger thought about, the leader to the employees, to the people, to the brand itself. So it's all – I see something visual. I'm not sure what shape it is.
Yeah, it is. There is a visual of it that it's an overlapping Venn diagram, because, as a consultant, I have to use Venn diagrams. It's a requirement.
They don't let you in. They don't let you into the consultants.
You have to use Venn diagrams, and you have to quote Seth Godin at least one point when you're giving a speech.
Yeah, otherwise they take away your card.
Yes.
So I was joking that I was going to get back to bacon, but if you talk about the kind of bacon brands versus the oatmeal brands, I got to make sure I can say this, so I'm going to say it slow and deliberately, the bland brands.
Yes.
Is it possible to take a basic brand, an oatmeal brand, say there's someone that is a manufacturer of a real complex and hidden part within some larger thing, but a pretty traditional type company. Can you make a bacon brand out of that?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I love doing that. I love doing that. One of my sort of overall mantra that I tell people is that inside of every brand is a truth waiting to be amplified. So that truth, you connecting it back to this concept, can you take an oatmeal brand and make it a bacon brand? That truth is really centered around two or three things. One is the values of the organization. If a company is values driven, there's bacon there. The second is how looping back to our kind of a previous statement, but it's how wherever there's positive treatment of other human beings, there are stories waiting to be told. And the old mantra of no brand, no story, no story, no brand, that comes into play here. And then the third area that you do that is you have to understand, you have to redefine or reframe from the marketplace what value is. This is the old value proposition methodology, discussion, but in through the lens of branding. My premise is that a value proposition is just the financial side of an emotional connection to a brand. It's the same. It's one's the root, the other's the fruit, but it's the same tree. And so when I go into a company, what I first start with is that values audit. And if they have values, if they are some really positive organizational behavior, some leadership habits and everything, that's where I start. So I would flip that around. When can you not do it? You can't do it if you don't have any values. If you're the primary reason for you for being a business is to finance your internal problems and grow your stock price, I can't help. That's an unhelpable situation. The second is capitalism well, capitalism is supposed to determine the winners and the losers. And sometimes the marketplace is telling you that you suck and you got to go work on something else. You shouldn't even be worrying about your brand. You should be worrying about, you know, maybe your products that you're selling. One of the things that I've observed over and over again is a lot of companies think they have a branding problem. What they really have is they have an everyone knows you suck problem. And that's not a marketing doesn't fix that. No Super Bowl ad will fix that. So that's how you do it. And so certainly there are indicators of when it doesn't work, but it's typically around when an organization doesn't have a value set. You know, they got a bunch of posters on their conference room walls about working together, but they don't actually do it.
That's like the corporate culture version of our consultants Venn diagram, you know.
That is exactly right.
We have the culture now. See, we made those posters.
Right.
We came up with a list of words and found some great stock photos.
Framed them all. We had HR do an internal campaign on engagement.
Now we have culture. Next.
Now we have culture.
Crossed off
now,
the list.
Now get me my helicopter.
Exactly. Yeah. Now on to the helicopter. You said once I improved culture, I got the hang in there kitty posters up.
Yeah. You can really tell, Nick, when somebody's struggling with this, when they fire their ad agency or their CMO. That's the sure sign that they don't know that they're firing the wrong people.
Yeah.
Yeah. But anyway.
Well, and I think, you know, you get back an example of that. And again, I know that, you know, the big businesses are the ones that we pivot to because they're easiest. But you look back at like Howard Schultz with Starbucks a few years back, realized that all of that was starting to suffer. Recognized that it was that leadership's role in that and took action.
Yep.
As opposed to, you know, you look at the fast food companies or whoever with their, you know, big change, you know, agency churn and everything else.
And this is part of the whole concept of being extrinsically driven with these leaders that are extrinsically driven, partially because it's just the way that they were raised as leaders, you know, over the last 30 years, but they're constantly chasing the killer campaign.
Yeah.
You know, if we could just have a better slogan. So anyway.
Well, you know, it's interesting because you think about, you know, that's something we've not talked about, but you think about, you do end up, you know, in this campaign mindset. And campaigns are necessary, but I often think it's like Maslow's hierarchy of needs. You know, unless you have that brand base covered, I don't know that you can launch some kind of campaign without that foundation in place.
Yeah, in my methodology, the campaign is the amplification. So, let's just use, maybe it's because I'm in Austin, so I like to use a lot of music metaphors. But if you suck at playing the guitar, an amplifier does not make you better. It just lets everyone else know that you suck. And so, let's assume you know how to play the guitar. Then a campaign, then you plug it into an amplifier. You go electric like Dylan did, and then. Then the world knows. And then the other thing about a campaign is it really ultimately a campaign is not for brand awareness. That's a myth you will chase forever and ever and spend lots of money on. The purpose of a campaign, in my opinion, is to invite the world to think, to believe what you believe, and those that believe what you believe will then be motivated to learn more and then buy from you. It's an invitation. A campaign's an invitation.
So we talk a lot about personal branding here on the show. Mm-hmm. What role does personal branding play today? And how does that tie into what's going on? You know, you talked a lot about the people involved in a brand.
Yeah.
Leaders, employees, customers. And then taking a step back and looking at the potential for each one of those individuals to be a personal brand.
Yes.
How does that all tie together?
Yeah, I think it's kind of a convergence again, in that the leaders of an organization, and that could be the C-suite down to, and a leader is not really a title; it's more of a mindset or a role. They are the face of the brand, and so. But let's just take the senior leadership of an organization. When they brand themselves. Inside the company and externally, what they do is they accelerate the process of getting to know the company. And especially when the CEO does it. And you take the CEOs of, you know, say take Richard Branson, for example, does a phenomenal job of developing his personal brand in a way that elevates all of his business brands. Richard Branson could get into the toothbrush business and make $1 billion out of it because he built brand equity through his personal brand. Well, if Richard Branson can do it, anyone can do it. So what I teach, so there's really kind of two parts to this. When I teach, if it's a large company, I teach their senior leaders, and that's, you know, that could be 3,000 people or three people. I teach them how to go be the face of the brand. That's number one. The second side of this is more on the small business level, at the entrepreneurial level, where you're the product. Where you were bringing, say you're a consultant or a coach or a small business owner in some way. You have to be the face of the brand. You don't get the option. And I see this over and over again, these little companies hiding behind the logo. And no one knows who they are. They're not going pitching some generically named company when they are the interesting person. They are the product. They are the brand. But they don't know how to do market-facing activities. And or they see their competitors do that and they feel like it's being an over-promoter, being too pitchy. But there's a way to do it that's very authentic, and that's part of this whole concept of personal branding as I teach it, is it's around the authentic amplification of yourself.
Are leaders and businesses afraid of their employees as personal brands?
Leaders with very extrinsic value sets are terrified of that idea. Leaders that are very intrinsically driven, very connected to their values, love it. They love the fact, and that's why you can just basically look at organizational structure. An example is Zappos. We mentioned them earlier, but Zappos last year eliminated performance reviews. They still do benchmarking and performance benchmarking, but they don't do performance reviews where some manager sits down and gives his or her opinion of your performance. That is a cultural manifestation or a values manifestation of the senior leadership team of Zappos. But then you go the other way, which it's the command and control, the very 20th century industrial age mindset of command and control are terrified about the idea that employees or customers would be involved in the process of growing the company or growing the brand. That's why they use a word like engagement. And what really brands that have this 20th century top-down command and control mindset, when they talk about engagement, what that is basically another term for what can we make people do? And engagement to an intrinsically driven 21st century thinker is engagement means how can we co-create, collaborate, how can we inspire the people that touch the brand? And it's an entirely different thing.
So whether you're talking about personal brands, whether you're talking about employees, engagement, anything else, taking a bland brand, making it into a bacon brand, it comes back to an idea that was in your bio also that I underlined, was thinking about too, and that's the opportunity that comes but once for that first impression.
Mm-hmm.
How does that work for brands today? How are those people best capitalizing on that?
Well, you certainly have to pay attention to it. I mean, that's sort of a no-duh statement. You have to pay attention to it. You have to be intentional about it. And it's really around the first 15 seconds. Everything after that is, if you don't nail the first 15 seconds, I'm not sure the rest of it really matters. But I go back to that your first impressions are the fruit, not the root. They're the outcome, not the starting point. So let's just take a personal brand, because that's easiest to do, is if you have a person, a leader, a thought leader, someone in a leadership role that is connected to their personal value, they have self-worth, and then in the process of having self-worth, then it is going to manifest out to their behaviors. Those behaviors could be how they treat themselves through fitness or through self-improvement. There are a lot of different ways it's going to manifest itself with their personal behaviors towards themselves. But then how they treat others. Are they empathetic? Do they have high emotional intelligence? Are they good listeners? Then the perception happens. And they would say, well, he or she is very well dressed and very articulate and so nice. And I feel like they get me. Well, if you started there and said, here's everything I want to be, and try to work backwards from there, you would fail. That's like painting the house before you build it. It just doesn't work that way anymore.
And as someone that conducts a lot of workshops and seminars, what do you think brand builders today are missing in terms of like skill sets?
My blunt answer is empathy. I find this a lot, and I'll just be very direct here, Nick, that I find a lot of branders and marketers really don't like people very much. Starting maybe with themselves, if you want to get real navel gazing about it. they are often very dismissive of the ultimate owner of the brand, which is the people. So that's one thing. The second is this pervasive habit, this addiction to checkbox marketing. And treating social as some sort of checkbox. Oh, we have a Twitter page. Now we're done. They don't know how to use marketing as a relationship management tool. And the third is, I find a lot of marketers seem to have a massive gap in their intellectual resume about understanding how capitalism and the free market economy works. And it's because marketing and branding used to be magical. You know, that's Mad Men. You come up with a campaign and people are attracted and they buy and everyone gets rich and wears nice clothes. It doesn't work that way anymore. You have to understand the natural power, the natural influence of the free market, and that you no longer get to decide as a marketer how people think, feel, or behave around the brand. They've already decided it. All you're doing is trying to frame it in a way that creates a little bit more of an authentic connection. So I would say this. Branders today need to be farmers, not hunters.
You know, and that thought, too, kind of brings back to the full circle to what you said from the outset, that it's no longer this idea of, I mean, I think that the Mad Men era is a good time capsule of what you said at the beginning of the show, where it was cultivating the outside perception that we are going to project this at you and market at you enough that you will then believe that, as opposed to that farmer role that you're talking about.
That is correct. Yes.
And all of this tools and technology have turned everything around, that you can't be a brand builder, a marketer, and not like people, or at least
that's right.
Not be successful.
Yeah. Do you know who Hugh McLeod is? He's at Gaping Void. Yeah. One of my favorite cartoons of his says, if you treated your friends like you treat your customers, they would punch you in the face. And that goes back to just understanding the intrinsic value of humans. And the golden rule and all that other stuff. And here's the thing. This is what I'm so excited about in this era, is that brands that are run by self-aware, high emotionally intelligent leaders with empathy, they are kicking so much ass right now. It's not even funny. Look at the stock value of companies with great culture. Look at the crossover between best places to work and revenue growth and customer retention. It's almost overlapping. Yet these large brands losing customers by the droves, getting their hats handed to them by smaller, more nimble competition, are sitting around scratching their heads wondering what's wrong. And you really know that you've come up against a real innovator, a real disruptor to your industry when you hire lobbyists to try to put them out of business, like Uber's experiencing.
Right, right. Yeah, that sends a pretty clear message there.
Right.
So speaking of great culture and the golden rule stuff, what's a brand that's made you smile lately?
Yeah, I'm always looking and watching and, sort of a brand anthropologist the way. And so there's always this kind of rotating list of brands. The one that is my current favorite example is Alamo Drafthouse. And Alamo Drafthouse is a regional theater chain in Texas and expanding and beyond. They have now locations outside of Texas. And it's a dinner type – you go order food there. But there's a couple of things that they've been able to pull off. that are the million little details that make up a brand, and that they've executed them well. And in a couple of them that come to mind is there's a respect for the art of the movie itself. So the movie posters, old movie posters hanging on the wall, just the feeling that when you walk in, that first impression that we talked about. The second is they have behavioral expectations of their customers, and they stand by them. So they come on, and it's very clear. If you talk during the movie, if you use your cell phone, if there's a disturbance, you will be removed from the theater. And the third is the type of people that they hire, the servers and the bartenders, and they are believers in the idea. You can tell that they're engaged with the brand and the essence of the brand. So they hire people that are a reflection of their values and standards. And they nail it every time. And they have good food, and they do a bunch of little quirky things that just make the whole experience. Like, I would never go to another theater if there's an Alamo Drafthouse that I can go to. That's the power of it. I mean, you think about a highly commoditized thing as like a movie theater. They figured out how to take something highly commoditized and make it compelling and interesting and consistent.
Well, and that's what you've got to do today. I mean, in any business, but especially anything else that is a parody product or service. And, you know, you're not just competing with the other theaters. You're competing with, Netflix, Hulu, everything else. So
that is correct.
So where is a link that we can point people to learn more about who you are and what you do?
Yeah, fosterthinking.com.
Fosterthinking.
And that's my name on Twitter and Instagram as well, at fosterthinking.
All right. Well, we will link up to all of those in the show notes. Justin, thanks for joining us on Brand.
Thank you, Nick. It was very fun. Thanks for the awesome and interesting visit.
Awesome. Well, I always like to flip around the microphone before we wrap up to recognize our listeners, our people, our brand advocates out there. Wanted to give a holler to Danielle Rogers, who said some very kind words about the On Brand podcast last week at the AMA Iowa event in Des Moines. So big shout to Danielle and that great organization there doing great things. And as we said, you can find links to everything that we talked about. No virtual bacon yet, but who knows? Over at branddrivendigital.com, you can subscribe to the show via iTunes, Stitcher, RSS. Speaking of iTunes, a great reminder to head over to iTunes, click that star button to rate the show. If you have a few extra seconds, drop in a couple sentences and click a review or submit that review as well. And don't forget that this podcast is brought to you by our Brand Driven Digital event series. You can learn more about Digital Strategy Bootcamp and the industry-leading Social Brand Forum at branddrivendigital.com right now. Until next week, I'm Nick Westergaard, and I'll see you on the internet.
This has been the On Brand Podcast, presented by Brand Driven Digital. For show notes, links, and more, go to onbrandpodcast.com. Remember, you can subscribe to the show and leave a rating and review at iTunes and Stitcher. Thanks for listening.
This podcast is heard along the Marketing Podcast Network. For more great marketing podcasts, visit marketingpodcasts.net.